Chapter 33. The Arctic Circle, Greenland. Meditations of a Polar Bear.
My bones, like whale ribs in times of plenty, they press against my fur, dank and brittle. I have swum for days with a broken heart, hunting for a reason to swim and draw frosty air. I am the very last of the ice bears. Tornasuk! Tornasuk! The last of my hope rides on the wind. It is a metallic smell of blood and brine, the promise of a walrus ahead a few miles that spills red onto sparkling white powder. I follow with laden paws and vanishing body. The walrus is fresh. Tusks, now stationary swords. Blood pools on the ice, and then, in my frozen veins, as I see my once little cub who was swallowed by the sea. It is you! You have grown, Tornasuk. You and the others. We, Seals Dread, the hunters of the flow, the ice bears, have returned as the sea's fish have. You have made the ice your kingdom. The sky bursts with opalescent strokes of color that dance across icicle shadows. We eat, and the ice bears live on.
Chapter 34. ST, Linwood, Washington, USA. We were still gathered and grieving when our new kingdom threw its head back and roared once more. On the horizon, a pastel scarf whipped satin loops in the air, performing acrobatics. As it neared, the scarf revealed itself to be feathers. Cedar waxwings, with their silky gradient of dusky sunset colors and rakish black masks, came to us, panicked and breathless. "It's happening," they said, hearts trilling. "The one who conquers is in our territory." I turned to cry and saw a fire light in him, a smolder that lifted his flight feathers.
"It is time," he called. "Send word to all the crows. Rally our allies. We must fight for what's ours."
The crows mobilized with a cacophony of caws, and other birds followed suit. The air was filled with frantic wings, black, green, white, brown, blue, and yellow. Megisi dropped down next to me, chittering with anticipation. Woodpeckers drilled into the wooden telephone poles, sending a sort of emergency Morse code through Aura. News would travel on the wings of an Arctic tern and circulate with the keen and cackle of Echo's seabirds. Dogs barked and spun in circles. I hopped onto Megisi's back in a daze, and suddenly the dogs were getting smaller and the wind was ruffling my feathers and the elephants looked like Stonehenge from above, standing guard of our Dennis. Leaving him this time felt no different than any other time. My heart lodged itself somewhere in my brain, and my insides felt like chili con queso. Out of everything I'd been through, leaving Dennis was still by far the hardest thing I'd ever done. But I had no choice, because I lived for the two of us now. I lived for Dennis, and I lived for me, and apparently we both had an insatiable thirst for danger. And we had to save the one place where our crows and our domestics had a shot. This was the one thing we could control. When you have the power to stand up to oppression, you must. Time with the elephants had strengthened me, and I remembered myself. The crow in me had loyalty and passion. The mofo in me, hope. I was about to unleash a motherfucking hurricane. Megisi flew high over 164th Street, high above the small park and the lake where Dennis had been a hero and the hideous creatures had drowned. Flanked by thousands of wings, we headed south, mind maps guiding us with precision by UV light and strumming vibrations that turned our hearts into tiny ukuleles toward where the waxwings had seen the one who conquers infiltrate our territory. They had snuck up on us, invading while we were distracted by our grief and honoring our friend. We flew over the dying concrete jungle below, over carnage and decay, bursting beauty and the optimism of seedlings alike. A sign for Bothell Landing identified a park with its rusting climbing frame, weeds slowly digesting picnic tables, and the Sammamish River, gorged and swollen, snaking through hurriedly to other adventures. It didn't take me long to locate the one who conquers, only to discover that once again the Feathereds had let me down with their lack of a grip on plural nouns. The one who conquers was a they. More than one predator had taken down the gorilla at King Street Station. More than one had been terrorizing and conquering Seattle. In keeping with the calling of their blood, they had formed a pack. And now, below us, the pack was holding ground against the birds that mobbed them from the sky. Local crows, gulls, geese, with some brave and foolhardy charging from the ducks, and cormorants calling for backup from the river. Their power was immediately obvious. One wolf is a threat, a fearless assassin. But this pack was enormous, too many for me to count, and at the front of the legion of silver-tipped fur and seasoned fangs were four snow-white wolves. I knew them instantly, their rangy bodies and striking cool glow, white as snow-buried bones. The sister wolves from the Woodland Park Zoo. Big Jim and I had watched them from behind the safety of their enclosures as they wandered its periphery in a territorial trot. And here they were, freed and fused to a prodigious new pack that rallied behind them. I flashed back to the dead wolves I saw in Mill Creek's town center, a smaller, weaker pack that couldn't survive the new realm. Wild wolves who didn't have the leadership and savvy of the white wolves familiar with the ways of mofos. This pack was different. Larger, stronger, it had grown its numbers to survive. They had made lairs and eaten gorillas and become formidable. The wolves held their ground, backs of their stiff bodies arched, heads lowered in toothy snarls. Tails were tucked, hackles stood up like newly mowed grass. Birds dove at them, screeching a fight song, and I watched in horror as several were swiped from the sky and from this earth. Feathered mounds dotted the grass like molehills. Cry shot past Megisi and me, shouting directions to the black mass that was ready to die by his command. The crows cawed and began their mobbing, pulling at tails and facing lines of glistening teeth. And then Gubari was beside me, flapping in place, with Pressa by his side, the burns of her underwing exposed. "There is another threat," Gubari wheezed out of breath. Pressa took over for him. "Others are taking our territory not far from here. Cry has sent more crows and summoned for help through Aura, but he can't be in both places at once." "Show me," I demanded, and we took off as if shot from Sigourney Weaver, Big Jim's Marlin Model 336 lever-action rifle. We were skimming over trees, and my mind was whirling, and then we were above a golf course and a cluster of western white pines. Megisi, Gubari, and Pressa touched down onto a high branch, and we stared down at our next problem. Below us was another creature I had never encountered, and I was willing to bet that I wasn't alone in this regard. Dotted on the ground were strange black and white lumps that I'd seen before, each about the size of a packet of Doritos that gave off an acidic smell. And then I knew that these lumps were fecal matter. They were droppings. And what had made them was what had sent the formidable ant army running for their lives, daring even to take to water as a chance at survival. It dawned on me that the cocooned body Dennis and I had found in the tree trunk had been prey, woven tight and decomposing in silk. These were the weavers. I stared open-mouthed at the second hybrid monster I'd seen, something that was both mofo and not, with its strange horizontal body, dark mottled skin. It had a head where a head shouldn't be on a mofo body, surging directly from the center of its horizontal torso. And it looked up with fuliginous holes where there should have been eyes. Homo sapien, but not. And where there should have been a mouth, there was a mandible with a sensory pedipalp, jaws that leaked silvery strings of fluid. Its sides sprouted arms, but they weren't arms. They were legs, and everything about them, from their sharp angles to their coating of spiky hair, suggested that they were arachnid. The gift of animal instinct is this: knowing a danger before it has shown you its teeth. My animal instinct told me I was looking at an unspeakable danger to our world. "Look what they've done," hissed Pressa, pointing her beak at the trees below. The weavers, chronic and cancerous in their destruction, had burrowed into the trees, leaving great holes, scratched sap-streaming scars across their beautiful trunks. The decaying bodies of birds, raccoons, and squirrels were suspended in the trees, silk-wrapped and strangled. Cocooned corpses. I thought of Rohan's desperate conversation at the hospital. Cancer is a newly evolved parasitic species. Humans are becoming that cancer. The question begged, was the Earth healthy enough to fight off this parasite? I held back nausea as I watched them. These five lion-sized monsters with no names shift mechanically around the base of tree trunks. And then I lost the air from my lungs as I watched one of them rise up, lifting its horrible bristled limbs to the pine's bark and hoisting its enormous body. They could climb.
"We've been watching them move," said Pressa,
her normally cool voice stricken with dismay.
"They are heading in the direction of the campus. They're coming for us."
The domestic safe zone. Beaks and talons and the hollow bones of birds were no match for this type of predator. My first instincts were, in this order, to scream, run around in circles, shit myself, and perform a stiff-legged feint like those myotonic goats. But this wasn't a time to panic. It was a time for me to use my melon, every trick in my crow mofo mind. "Megisi, rise!" I yelled, and she did, Gubari and Pressa joining us in the air, lifting from the pines. I addressed Aura, calling out to nature's network for help. I asked for specific information, a location. Now, I was the one who was hunting.
"Look!"
cried Pressa, her feathers ruffling. A butterfly whose wings were the most brilliant iridescent blue fluttered toward me. A species native to tropical rainforests, she was at once delicate and a joyful icon of survival, a symbol of the impossible. How could she have survived this climate, this world? She was so very far from home. She bolstered me. Her glowing cerulean wings held my attention as she showed me a mind map by using her wand-like antennae to paint a picture in ultraviolet light. She watched me leave, and I felt that I was protected by her gaze. I knew then that I was being watched, cheered even, from worlds I couldn't see. My love for Dennis fortified me as I followed the directions from the blue morpho butterfly. Gubari and Pressa flew at top speed behind me, and I felt them on my tail feathers. We didn't have to go far. The ones I was hunting for were patrolling the large backyard of a mansion, their shoulder blades rising and falling as they skulked through the long grass. One of them was lying on a mofo's deck, resting, but always, always vigilant. His limpid eyes scanned for movement in the grass and the long-abandoned chicken coop. Another was busy marking his territory by squirting urine all over the place. Cats, I'm telling you. From above, their stripes looked like eels swimming in a blazing fire. I was almost hyperventilating. My head darted from side to side as I instructed Megisi to swoop around the surrounding area, being careful to steer clear of the brothers burning bright. A neighboring house, another McMansion with a front lawn covered in trash, seemed like it might have what I was looking for. Megisi touched down onto the grass, and I got to work, sifting through the piles, tossing up tissues, wine bottles, yogurt cartons, condom packages, and old editions of the Times, New York and Seattle. Gubari and Pressa perched on debris in the shadow of the enormous house. Pressa seemed unsure, sitting on the top of an empty Amazon box. Gubari hopped toward me as I spat various items from my beak and made disgruntled noises. Pressa hopped down from the Amazon box, eyed the clutter, then picked up something with her beak and plopped it in front of me. "How about this turtle egg?" she asked. "That's a golf ball," I said. "Hmm, this dried-up weasel turd?" she asked, gesturing with her foot. "That's a cigar." "How about this shiny chestnut?" "That's a Ken doll hairpiece." "Oh, colorful worm?" "A shoelace." "These corn kernels?" "False teeth." "Well then, what about this?" "This looks like a very useful thing." She was just so chipper and trying so very hard to be helpful. I didn't have the heart to tell her how off the mark she was, offering up a locket with its tiny amateur oil painting that was supposed to be Nicolas Cage, but looked more like a Yukon gold potato. I kept up my search, beginning to fear we'd never find what I needed. But when a young mofo's foreclosed Barbie Malibu dream house came into view, my hope surged. I hopped over to a pile of scraps left over from mofo children. Legos, Star Wars figurines, coloring books, and finally selected an item I felt would work, even if it was a little disturbing. Then I got to work on searching for the second part I needed.
"Tell us what else you're looking for so we can help," said Pressa.
I felt dubious. The enthusiasm was there, she just didn't know what mofo things were. How could she? "We need a snake. A long, dead, brown snake," I said. Pressa hopped determinedly behind an uprooted toilet and emerged victorious, dragging along a tatty old rope as long as our yard in her beak. It was perfect. "Dead snake," she scoffed. "What do you take me for, a turkey?" Gubari let out Rohan's melodic laugh. I thanked her and got to work plunging my beak into the side of the plush toy I'd found, ripping a hole in its side and spitting out fluff onto the lawn. Gubari helped me to push the rope through the hole, and I punctured another hole in the other side of the toy's head, slipping the rope all the way through it. I gave Gubari an inquiring look. He appeared satisfied with my toolmaking. Pressa seemed disturbed by my lobotomizing an angry bird. I did see the irony that the only plush toy happened to be a feathered. Next was convincing the largest and most powerful of us to help us carry out our plan. "Megisi?" The beautiful bald eagle was sitting on a small wooden chest she had broken open and was carefully studying the images of herself she recognized on 7 denominations of U.S. currency. Seemingly flattered, she ruffled her feathers, then took lunging strides toward me, which continued to be, quite frankly, intimidating as fuck. "I want to ask you a favor," I told her. She listened to me carefully and then let out a sharp shriek. Pressa looked panicked and confused.
"ST, you cannot ask her to do that," cried Pressa.
"Why not?" I said.
"Because she might die. Because you might die."
"Trust me, this will work. I'm using mofo knowledge here."
"You trust me, ST. Things that are hollow or mofo or whatever are dangerous to the feathereds. I won't let us die for this."
Pressa spread her wings to fully showcase the burns underneath. I felt so sorry that she had been injured, that somehow mofos had caused it, that we had such different experiences. Gubari intervened.
"Well, there's certainly no use in us just standing around debating like a married couple trying to pick a restaurant. What say we settle it like our, as you call them, mofos used to?"
"Fist fight!" I screeched.
"By respecting the depth of each other's feelings, but ultimately deferring to the only one whose decision really matters."
"Mine!" Pressa and I chorused. Gubari gave us a patronizing look. "He's good at those."
"Fine," I said. "Megisi gets the final say. Do we all agree on that?"
Pressa and Gubari nodded. The three of us turned to our eagle friend. Megisi had returned to the carpet of American dollar bills to study her ravishing likeness again, bored with all the arguing and the endless gibberish that flew from beaks. She had never been a bird for a lot of noise and language, but rather, she was an adventure eagle.
"Megisi?"
asked Pressa, her voice choked with worry.
What is your final decision?
Megisi threw back her bright white head and let out a scream that needed no translation.
What the fuck are we waiting for?
And that settled the matter. Pressa, I know you're worried. That's a thing we no longer have time for. Our friends are in danger and it's do or die. Or do and die. But at least one involves no regrets. I chuckled. This didn't seem to alleviate her worry. I remembered that in the animal kingdom, trust is not given away, it is earned. I looked deep into Pressa's shining eyes, echoing words she'd said to me the first time she dabbed my wonky wing in special herbs. Trust me? She nodded. I hopped onto Megisi, and she held the rope ends in her formidable talons. Gubari positioned the angry bird plush toy so that it would hang low to the ground as we lifted the rope ends it was attached to. Megisi rose into the air and dragged the angry bird below her. The bait. There wasn't any time for practice. We each gave each other a look. Gubari, resigned commitment. Pressa, panic and fear. Me, here we fucking go. We took off, and I felt the change in Megisi's flight as she dragged the long rope. An angry bird bumping along the ground, and another one riding a bald eagle out to rescue his murder. We flew over the fence of the mansion to where the big cats lurked. I felt fear that fizzed and bubbled inside me, tempered by a determination so strong I was dizzy with anticipation. The angry bird scraped against the top of the tall wooden fence, then dropped onto the grass and bounced through the weeds. It happened fast. The tigers acted on genetic instinct, something I was counting on. All three shot from their positions and lunged toward the bouncing bird.
Go, Megisi!
I cawed, and Megisi shot through the air, trailing the rope in her talons. Gubari and Pressa shrieked and hollered as they flew with us. I kept my eye on the tigers as they scaled the wooden fence, their agile feline bodies trained on a stuffed bird with slug eyebrows. We tore across backyards, using any obstacle we could, a paddling pool, climbing frame, barbecue pits, and fire tables, to our advantage. Megisi lifted up higher to pull the bird above these objects while the tigers had to navigate around or over them. But they were fast. Frighteningly fast. So fast that I felt quick rising nausea for fear that they'd gain on the bird and we'd lose our shot. Megisi yanked the bait over the last of the neighborhood fences and, terrifying an innocent herd of cattle who were congregated curbside and took off like their asses were on fire, trailed the rope down the length of a road. And this is where the tigers picked up speed and really showed their stripes. There were no obstacles to jump over, just a few vehicles to dodge. The smallest brother gained traction, and powerful back legs lunged him into an enormous leap, his body lengthening like a striking snake. He drove his claws into the body of the angry bird, and Megisi and I were yanked downward. She let go of the rope, and the tiger rolled with the impact of the attack, falling back to the ground with the angry bird. The three tigers circled the toy, shaking the earth with their growls, fighting over who got the kill.
"Fiddleshits!"
I yelled.
"We were so close!"
"Megisi, the angry bird has to fly again! We have to get that rope back!" Megisi circled above the tigers and the filthy plush toy, both of us looking for an opportunity to swoop down and snatch that line. But the cats had the reflexes of, well, cats, and all it would take is a swipe from one of those massive claws, and Megisi and I would be dead as door handles. Megisi chirped. "Not yet. Look, that one is watching us," I told her. And he was, with a ravenous look I'd given many a Cheeto. And just like that, in the manner of cats the earth over, they got bored. One of the brothers prodded at the angry bird half-heartedly. Another yawned and squished himself into a motorcycle sidecar that was too small for him. The third, the smallest and fastest, kept his eyes in the sky at the bird on the bird that had been puppeteering the stuffed bird. It was becoming a tiramisu of complication.
"Get up, you prison-striped meatloaves!" I screeched. The tiger, looking at me as though I should be slathered in basil aioli, threw his head back to roar at us. The other two were no longer focused on the angry bird. We had lost them. "What do we do, Megisi?" I asked. "It's like herding cats." I heard a desperate yell. "Pressa, come back! We'll figure something else out!" A hollow feeling burned inside. Failure. The tiger, spilling out of the sidecar, stood up, slinking over to his brother, and the pair turned toward a tree line. The brother with the anger management issues took his eyes off me, turning to join them. They were leaving. It was all over. And then Megisi's back muscles tightened. Suddenly, my stomach and eyeballs felt like they were suspended in the air above me. We were falling from the sky. Megisi dove, launching us toward the trio of tigers and yanking at a striped tail with her beak. She was not a deliberator. She was an adventure eagle. I called out, taunting them.
"Shh! Here, boy!"
The brothers turned and snarled, showing me the sheen on their fangs and a ferocity that chilled the air. "No! Don't! Come back! They'll kill you!" I heard Pressa squawk. Even Gubari started screaming for us to stop. But Megisi screeched and dove again, stirring up our scent for the carnivores and narrowly missing a paw swipe. She swept past two of the brothers and their raw meat breath, snatching at the ear of the third with her talons. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. The brothers chased us down the length of the road. It was on. Megisi flew fast, swift and low, keeping us as bait to engage them in the hunt. And then we were approaching a cluster of familiar western white pines, and a horrible acrid smell filled our noses. The outstretched fingers of pine limbs loomed before us. Megisi dove to avoid them. My skull rattled, filled with a thunderous roar. A tiger had caught up. Megisi tilted hard to avoid the tiger, who thrust himself into the air as she'd lowered. I felt his claw swipe and barely miss us, a cold gust on my feathers. I was thrown from Megisi, smacking down onto overgrown grass. I jumped to my feet, orienting myself. Megisi hovered close by, above the tigers. All three of them now stalking her, inching forward, teeth and wrinkled noses and rumbling fury. Her great wings beat the air like twin cloaks. Her legs thrust forward, deadly black talons clenched and extended like two grappling hooks. Glassy eagle screams rose to the pine crowns. She couldn't see the western white pine right behind her. "Megisi! Behind you!" I yelled. She didn't see the gigantic, intricate web, a silver tapestry knit among pine limbs, or the encased body suspended in its sticky grip. Her left wing swept backward, colliding with the gluey mass. And it stuck. "Megisi! No!" I shrieked. She screamed back, thrashing to free her left wing. The wing was pinned, delicate dark feathers fused to slime. Now she was within lunging distance of the big cats. The smaller tiger, the one with hunt in him, crouched. He would be the one to take her down. His brothers had accepted this. He readied to pounce. "Wait!" I screamed. "Look! Come for me! Look at my shitty wing!" I sprung forward as fast as I could, dangling my droopy wing as bait, hoping I'd get there in time, hoping I didn't have to watch them tear apart an adventure eagle. My head darted, eyes searching the ground around me. Tools! Mofos use tools! Rocks. There were rocks around. I snatched a sharp-edged stone in my beak, but it was no use. I was still too far away. The tiger was about to vault. A deafening sound sliced through our skin. It sounded like a train scraping on tracks. We flinched. The tigers spun away from Megisi, ears flattened. We had company. Strange creatures, neither mofo nor arachnid, focused their hideous heads, those black eye holes, on the three big cats that paced in panic. Then the tigers stilled themselves.
They lowered their bodies, and I saw a ridge of fur rise on their backs. One let out a huffing sound, a low, shuddering warning. In response, one of the weavers let loose a metallic scream. I hurtled to the western white pine and the horrible web that imprisoned Megisi. She thrashed violently, in danger of snagging her other wing. "Stay calm! Don't thrash! Use your beak now! Quick! You have to bite at it, Megisi!" I yelled from the ground below her. She stopped flapping, hanging by her captured wing, raking at the tangled white mass with her knife-like beak. With a sharp rip, she slumped onto the grass next to me. A small snowing of feathers fell around her. Megisi righted herself, mouth open in a panicked pant, and stretched out her wings. The newly freed wing was fused with sticky web and wouldn't extend. Our eagle was flightless. She hopped helplessly. Her beak pecked desperately at the glue on her feathers. I looked over at the tigers creeping toward the weavers, then snatched a stick from the ground. "Don't move! Whatever you do, don't touch the web strands," I told her. I lifted the stick in my beak to her wing, rolling it over the silver strings. They adhered to my stick in shiny, sugar-spun wisps, like the cotton candy cones at the Evergreen State Fair. I rolled the strand, teasing the last of the web from her dark plumage. Megisi's wings spread like some great mythical creature, power in every pinion. She burst from the grass, snatching me up in those great black grappling hooks, lifting us up into the tree crowns. She perched on a thick branch with trembling legs and worked hard on her breathing. And then came a fight. The tigers formed their formidable triangle as the weavers launched toward them. They moved as spiders, but with heads craned forward like sick mofos, mandibles leaking fluid as they screamed their wrath. The tigers used their power, claw and tooth, to rip off limbs. The weavers bit and swiped their angled legs and used their size to hold ground against the cats. The largest tiger brother took on two of the weavers, standing on his hind legs as he delivered powerful blows, roaring to bring the sky down upon them. The weavers outnumbered them. 5, I counted. Their movements were mechanical and fast, and they drove their mandibles into orange fur, causing the cats to burst into frenzied attack. 3 weavers scuttled like great ticks toward the second tiger. One screeched, snapped the striped tail between its fangs and palps, bit down hard. The tiger bellowed, whirled, sank its teeth into the face of the hideous creature, right near those black, black holes, and the 2 other weavers, waiting for their chance, leapt onto the great cat, knocking him to his side. They sunk their fangs into him mechanically as he thrashed and fought beneath them. One opened its mouth and let out a sound, a dental drill's wail. Then they lifted their dark abdomens where there were openings, and out from those openings poured slimy silk. They moved quickly, wrapping their binds around the cat who fought and fought. "No," I said under my breath. "No, no, no." The 3 weavers worked in unison, mimicking nature's mechanical engineers, wicked and strong, with the prodigious powers of a spider. But the tigers had something else. 2 of the striped cats each pounced on a weaver who spun a tiger in silks. With one vicious swipe, the largest cat tore a weaver's face off, clean as sliced sushi. Megisi cried out, cheering on the carnage. The second largest tiger brother lunged, sending his claws to his brother's aid, driving the horrible creatures, one now faceless and twitching, away from his web-wrapped bulk. The bound tiger wriggled and roared, slicing himself free of slimy binds. He leapt to his paws, shaking off slime. His eyes filled with fire. Cats fucking hate to be wet. His body tensed, readying to join his rescuers in their attack. The tigers had evolutionary advantage. And this is what I'd been banking on. They were masters, commanders of nature's killing instincts. The weavers were new, underdeveloped, and were about to get ripped to shreds by their seasoned opponents. We watched them getting dismantled, with their foul-smelling saliva and their sickly gray skin. I had learned about tigers from a National Geographic documentary that had triggered this whole bait idea from a channel dedicated to MoFo's reverence of the natural world. 2 million years of predatory instinct could not be denied, and as a weaver's head was swiped clean off its twisted body, I allowed myself an iota of relief. The power of instinct had killed my Dennis, and now I was harnessing it to save our skins. Below, the mood changed. Where there was war, there was now a little playfulness. And as the largest tiger continued his work dispatching the faceless weaver, his younger brother picked up a sickly, pallid limb, dragging it to the base of a pine trunk. He would dismantle it in his own time, with the cool confidence of a cat. Our work was done here. Megisi had rested enough to take to the sky once more, this time back to Dennis. Gubari and Pressa close by, we swooped down, my heart chiming at the sight of the elephant herd, still in close proximity to Dennis, though no longer by his side. Now, they pulled the leaves off nearby trees with their trunks, their soulful presence a welcome zen. And I was about to disrupt it all. Gubari and Pressa screamed and squawked, raising the alarm. Great gray ears and powerful trunks lifted upward to take in the odd sight. A crow, an African gray, and a bald eagle being ridden by another crow. Very handsome. Raccoons saw us. Goats did. Lascivious squirrels and moles and blue-bottomed flies. But they weren't who I was looking for. I was looking for the domestic dogs who were all still there, milling around near Dennis where we'd left them on 164th Street. They all looked up to the sky with the other animals and cocked their heads at the cluster of birds and their cacophonous rally cries. Megisi swooped right down in among the packs of dogs. Labradors, boxers, spaniels, and shepherds brushing their fur with the tips of her flight feathers. I could smell their earthy doggy smell, which lit a fire inside me as I puffed out my chest and in my very best Big Jim voice yelled, "Good boy! Come!" The first to leap to their feet were the shepherds, retrievers, a Doberman, and the collies. Fur along the ridges of spines stood to attention. Black, wet noses lifted to the sky. Then, perhaps caught up in the excitement or by the familiar calls from another life they must have missed in their marrow, others leapt up and joined us. Instincts. Megisi, my fearless friend and majestic beauty, stayed low with the mass of slobbering canines, some lightning fast, others plodding but with that contagious fervor that is second nature to a dog. And I sang out the MoFo words, "Shh! Come! Let's go!" And they pounded after me with their moist panting and their irrepressible enthusiasm and hearts as big as blue whales. We ran, with a sky full of cheering birds adding to excitement that already split up the sky with its lightning streaks. And it might be hard for you to imagine, but we ran like this, dog pack following low-flying eagle and crow speaking MoFo, for a long time. Megisi didn't give up. I, part MoFo, part crow, and proud to be caught in the middle of the two, didn't give up. The dogs didn't give up. Well, some of them did, but French bulldogs and pugs have respiratory issues. More birds joined us in feather and spirit, and more dogs trailed after the gargantuan pack. And eventually, we were at Bothell Landing. The air at the park was dark with mobbing birds. New murders had joined our sky sentinels and were attacking the one who conquers from above. The orangutans had arrived at the park. The young ones threw rocks from the safety of the grand firs. Their mother was at ground level, advancing toward the wolves, the birds mobbing them, buying her time. The male orangutan bared his teeth and coughed out warning calls as he swung his weight behind his fist and struck a wolf across its muzzle. The wolf yelped and fell, springing back up to sink its teeth into its enemy, the long ginger arm. The orangutan's hissing clowder of cats, streaks of ginger, brown, black, and white, arched their backs, swiping and lunging at predators many times their size without mercy. That insane tabby threw himself again and again at the wolves, evading the white menace of carnivorous canines, fueled by an endless ferocity. The wolf pack had done a lot of damage, and the grass was littered with the bodies of fallen brethren. I couldn't yet bear to look for Cry. I had to focus. With one final, "Let's go!" Megisi and I drew the pack into the clearing in the park and drove the mass of thundering domestic dogs into the wolf pack. And the wolves, who were so greatly outnumbered and sharp enough to recognize it, scattered. Megisi perched, and we watched as the mass of domestic dogs, terrorizers of squeaky toys everywhere, chased away the one who conquers. Even the four snow-white sisters, tails tucked between legs, vanished into the tree line like distant moons. Chapter 35. Coming Up for Air. The Song of a Humpback Whale. The soft prayer of seaweed. Kelp fronds sway their salute at the mercy of the waves. Listen. Their song holds the key to unlock living, like brain coral's clever creases, its grooved wisdom, or the sparks from the sentimental skin of an eel. Ocean's voice is old, graveled with salt, crusty as a barnacle whose life was spent dreaming of wings. The whims of a minnow echo in dappled liquid light, magnified 1,000,000 times so that they flash and flaunt like the spray of my breech. There are no small splashes. Our fins follow a journey made by a pulsing map in the chambers of our hearts. Driftwood dreams of warmer waters, guiding us past a great garbage patch. The last of man's excess spilling into world of wave. All is not lost. Whoever forgets to come up for air will wash up on shallow shoreline. Beach. Filling lung or gill is an act of faith. Swim forth come ripples of blue or ribbons of blood. Baleen ballad and spume smile. We will remember to count blessings like grains of sand, and always come up for air. Chapter 36. Nomadic Wanderings Across Washington State, USA. Sholitza, Female Wolf of Nomadic Blended Wolf Pack. There is a great change in the world, and we feel a greater one coming. And so we must keep light, silent as the snakes that sway the grass. Watching you from the shadows, our golden eyes are filled with flame. We are led by the sisters, white as bone, who paint the land with their paws on borrowed time. We are hunted. We sing by light of a great moon who dances in silver along the rivers and reminds the ocean how to breathe. We, all of us we, sing as one. Our song is for those who have left us, for those who are brave in their bones, for those who cannot sing. We sing to remember. We sing to celebrate a cloudy wisp of breath. And always, we sing for the pack. Howl out, old pain. It is a soft and sonorous magic. The changed ones are all around us, growing their packs. Swift on our paws, we must cover more ground and find refuge in the secrets the land has buried, listening to the wisdom of the water. The woods carry sounds in their slow rhythms, sounds that only a heart can hear. Fight for your family. Protect the land that holds you. We move as one because we are one. The code of wolf is family. The pack is why we rise. We wander for miles, home in our hearts, guarding our pups with the fiery wrath of a sky storm. For our enemies, the end is swift and red.
you will not see us coming. But now, we are hunted anew. We must roam, guided by the season's smell and the toothy gnaw of hunger. We are mountain wild and never lonely. The pack will fight to thrive for the dream of a den and the loud smell of a newborn pup. We all begin and end in blood, life's liquid. Roam, rove, conquer the land with our bodies. We are never lost and we never arrive as the pack seeks the journey. And as we protect the pack from the hunters, we will fall in love with each moment, singing to a moon that has loved us since we were stars. Chapter 37, ST, Destination Unknown. We had been successful in driving off the one who conquers, and for now, had earned ourselves one of the luxurious moments of this life. Stories shared by a fire I built, a match in the beak party trick Big Jim taught me, and now they all thought I was Hermione from fucking Harry Potter. We enjoyed each other's company, and a bag of marshmallows that we tore open and roasted on small twigs, as I extolled the virtues of mofos, such as the varied histories of different cultures, the beauty in their physical differences, their creations, laughter, and love. I told them about how mofos dedicate an hour to happiness every day with Pabst Blue Ribbon and heavily discounted tater tots. I told them about how even though mofos weren't born with wings, they made their own and put them on airplanes and maxi pads, and about how they flushed all their poops out to Echo. The crows thought this was super hilarious. I explained birthday cake as a spongy mattress of awesome with hidden rivers of delicious goo to celebrate having stayed alive a whole year. I explained how mofos measured time in German boobs and how their eyes rained when they were sad and also happy. I demonstrated, with a lot of flair, how moonwalking was different from walking on the moon. I had a hell of a time trying to explain Christmas, so I summarized it as, a fat mofo in a red suit died and then came back and cashed his treasures in a big red bag, and sometimes mofos went to the mall to sit on his crotch. I taught them commercial jingles and Seattle's signature song, Smells Like Team Spirit, and we practiced the hello, 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 hello part. We practiced the impossible pronunciation of rural brewery together. I told them about dancing and the wonder of books, and the world's greatest poet, John Bon Jovi. A favorite thing was when I talked about the food palace called Denny's, and its magical dish of eggs and ham and cheese and sauce. Man, they fucking loved that shit. Sometimes out of nowhere, they'd just chant, "Moon's over my hammy! Moon's over my hammy!" Honestly, they became big mofo fans. I'm pretty sure I converted them all. There were, sadly, some things that were just impossible to explain, like the plot of Inception and CrossFit. We continued to roost at UW Bothell and its wetlands with an army of domestic animals starting their new lives in our vicinity. We all banded together, a necessary adaptation for survival. We were an odd and unprecedented bunch. Birds and reptiles and great apes and cats and an arkload of zoo animals. A known adage of nature became our motto. Cry once said to me, "We are more powerful when we work together because we look out for one another by being one. That is the code of murder." Cry still said it all the time, so it was easy to remember. We stockpiled food, grew in numbers, and collected mofo things that the parrot pandemonium and I deemed valuable. We kept localized peace, even with some of the larger predators like the flamingo-snuffing snow leopard and the mama bear and cubs from the university public library who sought shelter from the changed ones. We all sought shelter. There were triumphs, like fending off the one who spits, who showed up in many forms and tribulations, like Orange the orangutan's beastly marital problems. They all stemmed from him discovering and coveting a healthy stash of Victoria's Secret catalogs. Cry thrived in his role as the head of the Sky Sentinels. Pressa became a true mofo apprentice, assiduously reciting mofo words and eventually Bon Jovi lyrics.
Gubari became an unspoken leader, enlisting the help of the elephants to keep the peace, though even they were anxious around a short-haired tyrant named Genghis Cat. Megisi was the only living organism brave enough to mess with that cat. She was, after all, an adventure eagle. There would always be dangers, especially with the ever-changing mofos, but we focused on our present joy, which blossomed like a pink valerian flower growing through a crack in concrete. Perhaps the darker times made the good times sweeter, like the caramelized edge of a marshmallow, but it's hard to say. We were too busy living to dwell on these sorts of things. One night, Cry, Gubari, Pressa, and a small assemblage of noble birds, a Steller's sea eagle, a northern harrier, and a sharp-shinned hawk, came to me. I now joined the murder as they met to socialize on the UW rooftops and roosted with them in the treetops of the North Creek wetlands. It was an odd group of austere-looking birds of prey who said they had something to show me.
"We are going on a journey. You can tell no one,"
said the northern harrier with resting death face. I had questions. "Where?"
"Shh!"
They all shushed me in unison, this strange, sneaky conglomeration of feathers. "It has to be top secret," said the enormous Steller's sea eagle. "We will not discuss any of this, not even among ourselves, until we have arrived." I looked at Pressa and Cry for confirmation. Pressa nodded in agreement with the eagle and his terrifying beak that was roughly the size of a toaster.
"Trust us," she said.
Trust. That raspberry-flavored treat was something I embraced, even cached, and though they didn't seem the most light-hearted of travel companions with their intense raptor expressions, I trusted Pressa, Gubari, and Cry enough to follow blindly. Once I had Megisi's promise to carry me, the matter was settled. And so, in the dead of night, we silently lifted into the sky. This was especially strange, given that we were all diurnal birds and how much Gubari loves his sleep. The air had grown colder, breathing ice into our feathers. We headed due north, following a mind map delivered to Megisi in the utmost confidence. The journey was indeed a fucking long one. We slept in evergreens, and by day, we flew over snow-capped mountains and rivers and streams that sparkled as if filled with loose diamonds. One morning, as aura erupted around us, we flew over the crowns of trees that were draped in a giant netting of silver silks. I felt Megisi shudder beneath me, and I knew that we were looking at the homes and damage of the weavers. We pressed on, through rain and sun, choosing to focus on our secret mission instead of the darkness that spun its savagery below. And I have to be honest with you here and tell you that I knew exactly what we were going for. It had been clear from the shine in Cry's eyes, from the barely contained excitement that threatened to bubble out of the northern harrier, and the hawk's incessant talon taps that this really had been a top-secret mission, just for yours truly. They had approached me in the manner Big Jim had when he offered Tiffany S. a ring with 3 diamonds on it that we worked double shifts to afford. And so, I already knew, as we left the safety of the sky sentinels and the boundaries of our recently defended territory, that Cry and this little circle of imposing birds had located someone for me. I already knew, deep within my bird bones, that when we'd land, we'd be met by a small lump of wrinkly folds. A slobbering codpiece of a canine who would eventually chew through and ravage my sacred Cheetos stash, bay loud enough that little black fledglings would tumble from low branches and wreak general havoc on the college murder. There weren't many bloodhounds in Seattle, so the longer journey made sense, and to be honest, I wasn't thrilled about the idea. How could any poor dog live up to my Dennis? I didn't want a replacement, but I didn't know how to turn down this elaborate gift, how to crush the excitement of birds with talons like pocket katanas. So I tried to think about other things, but found myself enjoying imagining what the pup might be like, whether he or she would, like young Dennis, bark at mustard bottles and have to overcome a fear of windshield wipers. I kept it to myself, and feigned total ignorance, concentrating on the beauty of the flight, from the hairy musk oxen that grazed happily on emerald hills to the pod of narwhals we skimmed above, darting between their majestic horns as they whistled a well-wishing song. What a surprise and a delight to see them so far south. But the farther we flew, the more I felt my heart quivering. The more I imagined a pair of stupid, melted eyes, and soon I found myself shivering with excitement. And I tell you, eventually, I just couldn't wait to meet him. Listen, I knew he wouldn't be Dennis, but I also knew I'd teach him all the things I'd taught Dennis while he lounged around and licked his nuts, terrorized salacious squirrels, or bulldozed the unruly flower beds on the college grounds. I wanted to scream my gratitude to Cry and my new friends for the touching gesture. It honestly took every ounce of my energy not to sing. And then we flew over a devastatingly beautiful landscape. I suddenly recalled the words of a waxy monkey tree frog I'd once encountered.
"Pass the Moonstone River," he had said,
and I heard his croaky voice on repeat as we sailed over a radiant river. Its waters looked exactly like the precious silvery white and icy blues of a moonstone gem. "What is this? Below us," I called out to Cry. While cruising below the clouds, he dipped his head to take in the breathtaking scene underneath him and said,
"Moonstone River."
I realized at that precise moment that the alpine carpet of trees were all pointing one branch north, guiding us forward, and the skin under my plumage erupted into microscopic mountains. How had that weird little frog known I'd be here? We eventually finished our avian tour with the Bering Sea and touched down to grass, surrounded by an abandoned village that had a sign that read, "Welcome to Nanukayuk, Tuksuk Bay. We do not allow drugs, alcohol in our community. Violators will be prosecuted per our Nanunkayarmiut tribal codes." There was an abandoned yellow seaplane, presumably how mofos flew to this remote village before the virus wiped everyone away. This had been the home of the Yup'ik, a First Nations people who were hunters and gatherers. A lineage of bloodhounds must live in this small village, tucked away in a sequestered envelope, an Alaskan sanctuary. We fluttered over to the top of a quaint little house which sat next to a mud-splattered ATV resting peacefully for eternity. And across from the roof where we sat was a mural that stopped my pulse. On a brick wall, someone with great skill, the skill only a mofo could have, had made a black ink drawing of a bird rising above an evergreen. In its beak, the bird held an 8-pointed star. Next to the bird was a perfect mofo handprint. My skin rippled with bumps. The bird was a crow. This was the same depiction I'd seen at the horrible Seattle townhouse with the drug paraphernalia and a mofo hanging by a rope and a litter of huskies that wouldn't have survived another day. I looked at my travel companions, raptors with eyes as sharp as a blade's edge, all beckoning for me to follow them to the open doorway of the tiny house whose roof I sat and shivered on. I hopped back onto Megisi's chocolate feathers, and we dropped to the ground. Dismounting, I shuffled up 3 wooden steps and through the frame of a green front door. Inside was chilly. There were cobwebs hanging over pots, and dishes littered the tiny kitchen sink. A charming old wooden stove, the likes of which I'd only seen on the History Channel, sat moodily, dreaming of hot stew. A pair of muddy boots rested lonely on the floor, calling out to be worn again. The northern harrier, sharp-shinned hawk, and the Steller's sea eagle all watched me. And surrounding the puppy, in front of the hawks and the eagle, in front of Cry, who gazed at them in awe, were 5 snowy owls. They had faces like perfect porcelain dinner plates, the alabaster plumage below their necks erupting into dappled black and white that looked like the salt and peppering of 1,000 distant birds in flight. The snowy owls were unsure. I could feel their uncertainty hovering like the motes of dust that danced through the cabin. It was written in their chatoyant yellow eyes. Cry was facing my new friend, the little wrinkled pup with his droopy eyes, his fat little fawn belly, and enormous spongy paws that he had yet to grow into. One of the snowy owls inched itself closer to the tiny puppy. Cry looked back at me, his eyes full of expectancy. He was looking to me for answers. Pressa's eyes were wide and shiny. The eagles and hawks parted, giving way to me as I approached the bloodhound pup. And as I stood next to the five magnificent owls who held their breath in my presence, I realized that it wasn't a bloodhound baby. It was a mofo baby. The tiny mofo was sleeping, bundled crudely in all sorts of material, kitchen towels, sheep's fleece, a paper bag, a pair of shorts. She was a little girl, and her cheeks were flushed like blushing fireweed blooms, her tiny hands balled by her sides. And the moment I laid my beady little hybrid eyes upon you, my nestling, I was a goner. I fell in love with the smoothness of your skin and the roundness of your perfect little face that felt like discovering a new planet and a whole new beginning, a new chance at life. The owls had done the best they could, bundling you in their feathers to keep you warm, feeding you with what they scavenged, mostly water and drops of nectar and fresh wild honey. But you were starving and malnourished despite their efforts, and so I vowed then and there, my nestling, that I would take over your care and I would be your guardian against this new world. I remembered how Pressa told me that all females are survivors, and you are no exception. This is the moment I vowed to teach you everything I could about how to survive the sharp edges of where we now lived. I named you Dee, after your Uncle Dennis, who I promised to tell you all about and who lives on in everything we do. Uncle Dennis, who floated away on the wings of a butterfly. And my big journey, the one I slowly tell you as a bedtime story, along with The Hobbit, because that's a goddamn classic, is how I know what I've told you is true, about how Mother Nature is not kind, but she is balanced. Every single one of us, from amoeba to blue whale to the tenacious bloom that dares to dream of tomorrow, have their own destiny-fulfilling journey as long as their minds and hearts are open, and how we are all connected by a web that looks gossamer but is stronger than a chain-link fence. And though nature is tough, she is always conspiring for your success, encouraging you to evolve. You can even hear her if you listen carefully. I am the one who keeps you, my nestling. I am the one who keeps us safe. I am the one who keeps the stories alive. I am the one who keeps up hope, staving off the black tide. I am not just one thing, but a combination of them, peacock proud and imperfect. And I have kept my promise that I would tell you everything when you were old enough to understand. As an honorary mofo, I'm here to be utterly honest and tell you what happened to your kind, the thing none of us saw coming. And somewhere, far away in a world we feel but cannot see, a bloodhound named Dennis now lives a dream where he chases rabbits in a field, trailing every last delicious smell to the ends of the earth and far, far, far beyond. And somewhere in the ocean is a giant Pacific octopus. She pours forward, fluid and bone-free, on the tail of a current. Only she is the current, a magical liquid wonder and the fluid sum of Mother Nature's wisdom. It is known. This has been a Hachette audio production of Hollow Kingdom, written by Kira Jane Buxton, read by Robert Petkoff, produced by Michelle McGonigal, directed by Charles McCrory, recorded at Hachette Audio Studios, post-production by Audio Media Production. Hollow Kingdom is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2019 by Kira Jane Buxton. Audio production copyright 2019 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.